If you're hearing this, it means tickets are now on sale for our streaming Cybactacular.
That's what we're calling the streaming show of our Star Trek V review that we toured last year. We filmed our Hollywood show, and it's going to be streaming on Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And the stream will be available for a couple of weeks after that. If you can't watch right at the premiere time. A couple of pieces of information about this. If you support us at MaximumFun.org/join and your membership is current, check your email inbox because Maximum Fun will have emailed you a promo code to get $5 off your ticket. And also, we have some VIP packages available that include a meet and greet with me and Adam. Those are going fast, so jump on that if you want a meet and greet VIP package. Again, it's greatestgentour.com to get your tickets for the streaming Cybactacular.
Here's to the finest crew in Starfleet.
Engage.
Captain Jean-Luc Picard, the U.S. Enterprise.
Commander Benjamin Sisko, Federation Starbase, Deep Space Nine.
Welcome to The Greatest Generation, Deep Space Nine. It's a Star Trek podcast by a couple of guys who are a little bit embarrassed about having a Star Trek podcast. I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm Ben Harrison.
You know, at this moment in time, Star Trek Las Vegas is this week.
Whoa, shit, really?
Yeah, when this episode comes out, this will come out on the 29th of July, which means we will be at Star Trek Las Vegas this week.
But like at the end of the week, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was really freaking out.
So Star Trek Las Vegas starts, I think, on the 31st and runs through August 4th or something. Mm. And we're going to be there the 2nd, 3rd, and the 4th.
Are we getting paid to promote this? Or like what's going on, Adam?
Here's what I'm saying. I am not promoting this at all. I think if there's one thing we know about this convention is that they could not care less about whether or not we're going to be there. They would probably rather that we not show up.
Yeah.
I had a great time last year with you, sort of crashing it.
I like being an anonymous attendee. And I especially like not worrying about getting paid 9 months later.
Well, there's that, and also having your payment information skimmed and then having to get new credit cards and stuff. That's another thing that allegedly they had to deal with.
Yeah.
That's great.
I mean,
yeah, I'm going to be paying in cash, which is why I haven't bought a ticket to the convention yet.
Yeah.
And won't until I get there.
We're going to bring the Uxbridge Shimoda debit card to Las Vegas and go to a casino ATM and pay the $8 ATM fee.
A casino ATM, a far safer bet than running it through.
That's what that $8 pays for, man, is security.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a great time last year, which is why I'm looking forward to going this year, Ben. It is days and nights of fun and debauchery,
yeah,
and drinking and good friends. We met up with a bunch of friends at DeSoto last year. Hope to do the same this year.
Yeah, if you're going and see us walking around, please come up and say hi. Don't feel like you're bothering us.
Yeah, we'll let you know if you're bothering us. We'll put Bill Tilly in between us and you.
I'd say the highlights from last year. Zebra hoof cup.
I'm going to write that wrong this year, Ben. I'm going to be a good sport about gift drinks.
Nothing makes me happier than knowing that the emotional war I've waged on you for the last 365 days has yielded results in you doing more problem drinking.
I think you learned something about me at that point too, Ben, which is if I've been drinking all day, I don't want a complex sweet cocktail in the form of a hoof.
Yeah.
I need simple pleasures at the end of the night.
I need to ask ahead of time if you've been drinking all day.
I hate to make that a thing. We'll just do a little lifeguarding of each other throughout. Vegas is the sort of place where things can get out of control, consumption-wise.
We're going to be popping brodes like they're fucking vitamins, man. Because they are vitamins.
That's right. Our drinking vitamins will save our lives those 3 days in Vegas. I'm excited for it. Which is all to say, I think, that while we will be crashing the convention and doing a bunch of drinking and hanging by the pool and maybe even a little gambling, I am up for whatever while we're there. And that includes crashing someone's panel.
No way.
Interviewing someone famous.
Not a chance.
I'm down for all of it.
If anybody famous wants to be interviewed, holler at your boys.
Yeah, who are our famous viewers? Not many of those. What are you most looking forward to, Ben?
I think that a thing that I really enjoyed last year was watching you resist the temptation to buy a Captain Kirk jacket in the merch hall. And I'm wondering, I feel like your defenses may be even weaker this year than they were last year.
If it's there, I dare say it will be bought.
Wow. I recently went on the website of the company that makes the Captain Kirk away team movie jacket, and it was like sold out or something. So
the thing about that jacket and buying it, Ben, is that if I were to buy it, it would have to live at your house.
Why at my house?
Because there's no way I'm going to be allowed to have that thing here.
Your wife would not permit it?
No. She would not permit it, and also I would have to explain it. I would just rather avoid all of that.
So you're deferring all of the responsibility for that onto me, the guy who doesn't own the jacket, but would still have to get a divorce over the jacket.
But how great would it be to show up at the pool at the Rio wearing the jacket and swim shorts?
Oh, man, the Think Geek TNG Speedo and that jacket combination is a pretty hot look for summer.
I mean, I think you can see the video getting very popular, right? Jumping into the pool wearing the jacket. Going down the water slide in the jacket.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, baby. You've seen the footage from those pool parties. People go into the pool in Klingon loaf, you know?
Yeah.
That's how you catch a fucking disease, man. A disease like the one in today's episode.
Wow. You get into the pool at the Star Trek Las Vegas hotel, you're going to come down with the quickening.
It's season 4, episode 23, Adam.
Also called The Quickening.
Do you realize how incredible this is? No, of course you don't.
Hey, is that pylon okay?
I was wondering the same thing. I think we need a pylon update.
They strategically only showed close-ups of the ops and promenade section of the station, avoiding any exegesis on whether or not the pylon is okay.
It's like a kid showing up to school on picture day with a zit and like turning their face just so, so that you can't see it.
Yeah. You know what the big maintenance concern is on the station, Adam? It's not that pylon that got shot clean off. It's that Quark has been going around the station hacking all the computers to show an advertisement for his bar.
Come to Quark's Crush's Fun. Come right now. Don't walk. Run!
This is something that I feel very acutely because I don't know if you've been over to my house during the warmer months when the plane carrying the Geico banner has flown over. There is just a fucking plane and a fucking Geico gecko banner that just flies all around the city when it's nice. Yeah. And it is the absolute worst.
They should like suddenly the Second Amendment, meaning that everybody can have surface to air missiles, seems like a reasonable interpretation of the law.
You know what would be great is to spend some time out in the backyard, maybe do a little gardening, have a layout even, mm-hmm. play some badminton, and a low-flying aircraft, maybe 500 feet off the deck, carrying a fucking picture of a gecko flies over, as if we could ever forget their stupid fucking company.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. The nerve.
They must just be raking it in, right? Their cost of customer acquisition must be so astronomically high, given how much money they spend on advertising.
It must mean that you pay more when you have their insurance, right? Because you're paying for that advertising budget.
Yeah.
I hate them so much.
I hate them too. I wish they weren't the car insurance that we had.
If you're a viewer and you work for them, someone tell them not to fly airplanes over my house.
And tell them not to do it at the beach in New York anymore either, because I used to go to the beach in New York and they would do that shit, that same dumb airplane all the time.
Same airplane.
Yep, probably.
Quark and his methods, I must admit, fairly cute.
Oh, I love the part where my name rotates around.
He's gotten into the guerrilla marketing. But he's doing it everywhere. He's laser focused his marketing even onto Worf, who, when he replicates prune juice on the little D, it comes out in like a Hallmark singing mug that does the pitch for Quark's bar when you turn it on its side.
I am trying to find this prop as a thing that you can get.
It's got to be a thing that you can get.
I don't see it anywhere.
What?
This is a prop that can be made into a sellable item. I don't understand why it doesn't exist.
I love that it's got a picture of Quark and it says free refills and then asterisk limit one per customer.
Yeah.
Like, there's so much in that. It's really funny.
There's a cheapness to the mug that is also very affecting.
Yeah.
Like, it does not look like a good piece of merchandise that Worf brandishes here.
Like, it looks like those vinyl letters that you get at the hardware store to make a sign, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that's the quality of the printing.
It's what my wife would call cheap and cheerful. I love this jingle also.
Yeah.
Very catchy. I feel like O'Brien's sort of like a witness to this. Not doing a whole lot besides having to be the one that repairs all the shit with Quark later. But I feel like he's tapping his engineering dildo against the palm of his hand in the rhythm of the jingle at the end of this scene.
Mm.
Like it's an earworm.
Oh, he's got it stuck in his head.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those scenes where it's like, hey, these are some characters on the show. Okay, now we're done with them.
About 30 minutes into the episode, I was like, I wonder whatever happened to Quark's marketing plan. If you have questions about this at any point in the episode, they will not be answered.
Ew.
What do you call this story? It's not a sea story. It's just buried.
It's literally a cold open that is just there for levity.
Yeah, because the rest of the episode is just one A story.
It's one super heavy A story.
Yeah, we get there via runabout, and it's a runabout with Bashir, Dax, and Kira inside, and they're doing a survey in the G-Quad when they have to divert to a planet that has sounded a distress signal.
It's a planet that is just outside of Dominion space, so something that they shouldn't be terrified to go to, but it's antenna up, you know?
Right.
Which is interesting, right? Like, I don't think that up until now we've ever gotten the sense that there are, like, really well understood borders to where the Dominion is and isn't.
No.
And I don't know if the wormhole is within what the Dominion claim as their territory or not.
It seems unclear if the Dominion feel a certain way about territory, even.
Right. Like, it sort of seems like the Dominion just consider everything to be theirs and, you know, it's either under control or in the process of being taken under their control.
Right. The Dominion, of course, are a lot like my dog, which doesn't care about toys unless other dogs are playing with toys, and then he goes and steals those toys.
Yeah. But Bashir and Dax beam down, and I really liked this this shot where this is an episode directed by René Auberjonois.
Right.
And a really fun matte painting work in this episode. Really?
Yes.
Does a maybe more than any episode of Star Trek heretofore does a great job of establishing an environment and a sense of place and atmosphere and feeling in just this opening shot.
I saw a picture on the internet today that showed what Bo Peep looked like in the first Toy Story movie versus what she looks like in the one that's out right now.
Uh-huh.
And it was just making the case that, wow, you know, animation's come a long way. Pixar's come a long way. Like, even at the time,
yeah,
like back with the first Toy Story, it was breathtaking. And now look at it. This feels like the same leap with matte paintings has happened here.
Right.
Like, what we're seeing in this episode seems so much more sophisticated than we've ever gotten before. And there's even like a what feels like a time lapse later on with this painting. Like, they're using it, yeah, in a very sophisticated way. Very good way that I hope they're able to stick with.
I don't really know how you pull off a zoom with a matte painting, because this is like a shot of them beaming down and they're pretty much taking up the whole frame when they beam down, and then it zooms way, way out and it reveals a whole city skyline and like minarets and domes and a main road. And it's one continuous shot. I have no idea how that's accomplished.
Yeah.
It really is stunning and makes you feel like you're on an alien planet. That they were able to like make this one shot work and then make it work consistently with the shots where it isn't a matte painting, like all the times when you're just with them walking around in the streets of this place and it feels consistent. It's really well done.
I know we didn't plan this, Ben, but we have the nominees for best location in season 4 of Deep Space Nine, and
wow.
I have the envelope.
Oh my goodness.
I have the envelope. Here we go. And the winner of best location in season 4 of Deep Space Nine is this mystery planet. for all the reasons you stated, like it's totally developed and built, and it's out of nowhere that they did this.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it does not have a name, and all of the aliens here are human, and none of that is mentioned. Do you need that?
That's a real like TOS and early TNG technology. Of like the people that live here look exactly like us.
But we can't mention it because it breaks the spell.
Right.
Yeah, that's Star Trek magic.
Their loaf is the Blight.
Right. They aren't on the surface very long before Bashir interacts with a woman known as Norva.
Yeah.
And she has got the quickening.
It's a grim place, right? Like there seems to be sewage running down the street and... the first thing they walk by is somebody with like a shopping cart with a dead body in it. And then this woman runs up to them and she's got red lightning bolts all over her face. And she's asking to be taken to Trevian. And, Bashir is jumping into doctor mode. Like he gives her an injection before he even tricorders her, which is like a pretty big leap from a, like making sure she's got the same kind of biochemistry as he does standpoint.
Bashir's like, I've examined her urine thoroughly and her physiology is very different and incredibly delicious.
The flavor is delightful. And this one bald head dude is like, you're not from around here. You should go.
Yeah, this is Epran. Not to be confused with Apran, which is who I am. He warns Bashir of the Blight and... he is of the opinion that Bashir should just leave versus confront this Blight.
Right.
So it really sets the tone.
It really does. Goldacott. 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 So, Trevian is a hospital, and Dax like runs off to find out how they can get to it.
Trevian is the name of the man, not the name of the hospital.
Well, she says it's the name of the hospital, but it turns out to be the name of the man.
Okay. All right.
Dax comes back and says, I've gotten us transportation to this hospital. And Bashir's like, that's great, because I just met a guy and he was a dick. So I assume all people here are dicks.
These aren't exactly the friendliest people I've ever met.
And Dax explains that she's been able to secure this information by bartering her hair tie. So she's going to be hair down for the rest of the episode.
Not a bad look.
Yeah.
But if you want to get down to work, I think you need to tie it back, right?
She's out of uniform, but she looks great.
Yeah, if you're going to be doing medicine on people, I think you got to tie it back. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
Keep those stray hairs out of the quickening, Ben.
I have a good friend who's got a company that does a lot of work in the developing world, and they have a particular interest in advancing the cause of global health and public health in countries that don't have as many resources as ours. And when the Ebola outbreak happened a couple of years ago, like he was like in Nigeria for that. And I was like, holy shit, what is that like? Yikes. And I kind of had the same feeling in this episode that like they are walking through these streets and this place that obviously has like way lower sanitation standards than anywhere you typically visit in a Star Trek context. And I really admired how Bashir and Dax did not exhibit
like fearful body language around people. They're just jumping in and helping. They're not worried about catching something, you know?
It's aspirational and kind, but also there's no one they've encountered that is asymptomatic.
Right.
And if you've beamed into a place where everyone has the quickening, it's okay to betray some nervousness about that. But I think that's taken care of fairly early on, because like in Bashir's very brief scan of that first person, he's like, their physiology is so different from ours, we're not in any danger of contracting this. So,
and in fact, I should not have given her that injection, because that has made it much more painful for her.
He's like, the only way you can contract this disease is by drinking their yurt.
Oh,
I mean,
it was worth it. Somebody on Reddit was like, where did that whole Bashir loves piss thing come from? It didn't come from anywhere, man. We fucking made it up.
I'm making magic hands right now, man. We just conjured it with my mind.
We just figured that out about him.
Yeah. I mean, really, the clues were all there.
Yeah.
No one has a collection of thermoses and is not also a piss freak.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what those have in them.
That's why they smell so bad at thrift stores. You ever find a good-smelling thermos, you buy it.
They carry this lady to this hospital, and some orderlies come, and they're like, oh, she's quickened. Take her to Trevian.
Trevian?
And they're like, I thought this was Trevian.
Trevian.
And they're like, no, Trevian.
Trevian.
It's a man.
Hotel?
Not a place.
Trivago.
And then Trevian appears, and he's like, ¿por qué no las dos?
Yeah, and then they... I'll put them up on their shoulders and raise them over their heads.
Trevian is Kevorkianing his way through this episode.
He's kind of like if Mother Teresa and Jack Kevorkian were one person.
He's Mother Kevorkian. But here's the thing, and this is, I mean, if we're going to talk about what an episode is trying to say or how it relates to a contemporary issue, like this is an assisted suicide episode. And so Trevian embodies the position of mercy killing.
Right.
Because once someone contracts the quickening and their blue spots turn red, that's when the pain sets in and you can die really painfully, and it takes a long time to do that. And so Trevian has made a tea.
Yeah. He's a mixologist, if you will.
He administers a grape Kool-Aid to those with the quickening.
Yeah.
And he's able to hasten their demise, but the way he sees it is that it's compassionate to do that, because there's no cure to the quickening.
He really butts up against Bashir because, I mean, he is an ideologue of this kind of compassion. In Bashir's mind, like, the thing you do when someone is sick is you move heaven and earth to save them. And
right.
Trevian
lives on a planet and in a context where that is utter foolishness. And so they have a major ethical difference of opinion.
The way you get to a point where you don't find
Trevian
evil is because of his life experience being that he has moved heaven and earth, and it didn't do anything.
Right.
They all tried as hard as they could to cure a thing that they have found to be incurable. And so I think that's why by the end of the story, you don't see
Trevian
as an evil man. Like, if he were truly evil, he would be anti-vax. He would be anti-medicine. He would be anti-research.
Right.
But his life experience is just that he's tried everything, and he's like the guy with the morphine on the battlefield.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes field medicine, just all you can do is make someone comfortable.
What he explains to them is that this is a Jem'Hadar project. They resisted colonization or takeover by the Dominion, and this was done not just as retribution, but also as to like set an example for other worlds in the quadrant. The planet that they live on was not unlike Earth in many ways. They were, you know, starting to explore and starting to visit other planets and become an advanced society, and this happened to them, and now they are like medieval peasant level of technology.
Up in the runabout, Kira has scanned the planet and like cross-referenced it with the names they have in stellar cartography. And it explains why the planet's name is Planet Look at What You Made Us Do.
Yeah. Alamarin, come to Fort. Alamarin, come to Fort. Alamarin, come to Fort. What are you doing? Alamarin, come to Fort. What are you doing now? Alamarin, come to Fort. Exactly.
It doesn't seem in keeping with the founders or the Jem'Hadar's sensibility about like leaving anyone alive. It just seems like they would slash and burn and move on.
Yeah, because Trevian keeps saying like, don't ever fuck with the Dominion or the founders because they'll do this to you.
Yeah.
And I don't think we've ever felt like this was one of the potential outcomes of resisting the Dominion.
Yeah, like, has biological warfare been on the table this whole time?
I don't know.
Seems like it's on the table now.
Yeah. They leave the hospital, and they're, like, back outside hanging out. Dax has discovered where the distress beacon is that brought them here, and it's just, like, equipment that happens to still be plugged in some building that
right.
has probably been abandoned for hundreds of years. And the doctor's like, all right, like, let's get out of here. This is a fucking disaster, and it's really bumming me out. And as they're making this decision, a young woman walks up to them, and she was in the hospital. She kind of noticed them, but didn't speak up then. But she comes up and introduces herself.
Her name is Ikoria.
Oh yeah,
and she has Dax and Bashir set up a clinic in her home.
And kind of gets Bashir onto the idea that, like, hey, like, you're a doctor. Like, we don't have those. We have Trevians, you know? Like, we need maybe, like, a fresh set of eyes, right?
Well, nobody around here seems to want our help.
I do.
And so, like, they talk to Kira, and they're like, and Kira's like, hey, there's, like, a pretty good chance that the Jem'Hadar are going to come, like, patrolling around, and if they find a runabout in orbit of this planet, it's going to be trouble. So she is going to go take refuge with the runabout in the Gymkata Nebula, which is a nebula with gymnastic thrills and karate kills.
When gymnastics and karate are fused.
So she's just going to enjoy herself there for like a week and then come back and scoop them up.
If there's one person on this show who would enjoy that, it's Major Kira.
Yeah, totally. I feel like Worf would enjoy gymnastic thrills and karate kills.
That's fair. Bashir really develops an affection for Ikoria, and he sort of realizes why he became a doctor to begin with. Like, this is him in his element. Like, he wanted to be a frontier doctor from the pilot episode, and here he sits. But one thing that also calls back season one Bashir is that he gives Ikoria an examination by sitting behind her and wrapping his arms around her, like he's teaching her how to bowl.
Yeah, or make pottery as a ghost.
Yeah, you didn't have to give an exam that way, Dr. Bashir.
Yeah.
But this is like a moment for them to bond because Ikoria is pregnant, and that's concerning on a number of levels. It's because on the planet, many of these babies are born with the quickening.
All babies are born. Everybody's born with it, and everybody dies from it.
It makes pregnancy kind of a sad thing.
Yeah.
And Ikoria is definitely wearing this sadness.
And I think that, like, one thing that they kind of imply but never say out loud is that their population is collapsing because so many people die young that the idea that you would live to an age to reproduce at all is in question, and I would imagine that lots of people choose not to even try in a context like that.
It would seem as though sex could be very painful if you're rubbing blight against itself.
Legion on legion.
Yeah, that's no good. But Ikoria is given hope in her relationship with Bashir, so much so that she decides to bust out her death rations and share them with Dax and Bashir. Death rations are a concept that we're introduced to early on in the episode at the hospital, because that's where these are enjoyed. When Trevian gives a person with the quickening the medicine with which to die, they enjoy all of these nice things that they saved up. And that's like part of the comfort that is given to a patient at the very end. Like they get to eat all of these nice things, they get to wear all of their best clothes one last time, and then they die. And so like this show that Ikoria does here by busting out her tins of pickled vegetables and whatever else she's got hidden under her desk.
Ikoria's a hipster and she's just super into canning, you know?
Yeah, it proves that she's in it for the long run. And she's willing to sacrifice those rations for a little bit of hope.
I read a thing recently that the ancient Egyptian civilization, like it lasted like a super long time in terms of like what is normal for like sophisticated civilizations. And one of the theories behind why that is that when super rich people died, they were buried with all their wealth, and like skimming excess wealth off the top of a society as a matter of course, like as a routine, like stabilized their society for a really long time.
Oh, because wealth wasn't generational the way it is now.
Yeah, thought that was an interesting thing.
They're really onto something there.
Yeah.
Good ideas.
I don't know.
It's the 1% of the pharaohs that take 99% of the profits.
The pharaoh class has far too long. The 1% of pharaohs. Anyway, I think that for all of this episode being about whether physician-assisted suicide is a good thing, it is also about like whether or not it is okay to give hopeless people hope. And I think that is kind of like the middle act of this episode is about Bashir starting to get encouraging results from doing science on what's going on here and infecting the people with hope. And Ikoria is the avatar of that feeling of hope. She's a young pregnant woman who is excited about what's happening, and Trevian is very against it, you know?
We'll have none of that hope around here.
Yeah. I don't want to be out of a job.
Yeah, I mean, unclear what the economics are of death in this society.
Yeah.
What he seems to be is so cynical that he won't even consider false hope as something viable. Like,
right.
He would rather not have even that.
Right.
As someone who I think has had that many times before and he's had it dashed. He's just a guy, like the lights have gone out in his eyes because he's seen so much death and suffering. He just can't see a way around it.
He's sick and tired of this fool me once situation and has a real like deep difference of opinion with Bashir about what is good for people in that context.
So the idea of Trevian's rejection of this false hope is based on, you know what, it's like not, it's not put in these words, but it seems like charlatans have come and gone before.
Yeah.
And it's not just that people have promised things that didn't end up working. It's that people have like profited off of the hope in a way that has cemented the cynicism that people like Trevian have.
Right.
And so if Bashir's going to make any of this work, you would imagine at some point he's got to make Trevian into a believer. He's got to make Ikoria into a believer. And he's got to make Eprin into a believer, too.
Low-key, the most fucked up scene in the episode is how Bashir achieves that, which is like amidst a rabble in the town square, grabs a little kid with a broken arm and cures the broken arm.
I love Dr. Bashir David Blaining that kid. Like he totally street magics him.
Oh, you have a fracture right here. I bet it hurts. Better? Oh.
It almost makes him seem like more of a snake oil salesman.
Stop putting wood soda in our mouth!
And like, that is exactly what street magic is.
I know. And it's like, from an ethical standpoint, like grabbing a kid and shooting a laser at their arm seems like a bad way to practice medicine, but it does have the effect of like convincing a bunch of people. And so like, Bashir gets a dozen volunteers, and they come invite themselves into Ikoria's house, where Bashir has like fully clinicized the situation. And now he has like a point of comparison between people who are kind of pre-quickening blight and then and post-quickening blight, or blue and red is probably the easier way to think about it.
You know, even pre-quickening, Ben, can get a woman pregnant.
Yeah, that's why you got to pack a vest. You cannot use the pull-out method. It's not a reliable form of birth control.
Ypres, like first in line here.
Yeah.
He tells Bashir he's canceled his death, which I thought was a great turn of phrase.
Yeah, he was really looking forward to it.
So Bashir has administered some drugs to these people, and later on that night, Ypres not looking so good. He began by responding well to the treatment, but he's kind of gone downhill. And interestingly enough, Ikoria has been field promoted to nurse. Like, she's helping administer the drugs too.
Yeah,
she's like taking a real role in this whole thing.
She's like almost PA level. Like, she's like administering injections and like doing bedside manner and everything.
Yeah.
And
Ypres sort of crashes. And he's flopping around, and the quickening has quickened. And that's because the illness has mutated. And it has to do with their equipment and their equipment's EM fields. Like, Bashir runs around and unplugs a bunch of his gear, but it's too late. Ypres is dead. RSVP Ypres.
If Bashir had brought the ethics board of his research institution out to the G-Quad with him, I think they might have taken exception to them administering the antigen to like a dozen people at a time.
Yeah. But you need a test subject, right? Not two dozen test subjects?
Yeah. Shit goes fucking sideways. And
this scene is terrifying, isn't it? Because everyone's flopping around, everyone's moaning Bashir's name.
It is a cascade failure, and I thought that it was so interesting that Trevian and Julian kind of sounded similar in these people's mouths.
Oh.
Because Trevian shows up and it becomes clear that they are actually calling out for him. And
wow.
He is helping people escape the pain of what Bashir's kind of half-cocked research has led to.
Yeah, I mean, whose name are you going to call out if the pain that has been promised to you from everyone that you know and love is finally there? You're probably calling for Trevian.
Trevian!
You're right. It's a terrifying scene. It's, I think, beautifully lit, very scary makeup on the sick characters.
We don't talk a lot about Alexander Siddig as an actor, but I think his ability to react to this moment is well done. Like, this is the worst thing a doctor can experience on a scope that we haven't seen in the show.
Yeah.
And it's awful to watch him go through.
Like, it is scenes like this that make me feel sure that doctor is not my calling in life, because this is like such a terrifying idea, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I want to stay well clear of making decisions that lead to 12 people dying all at once.
To be quite honest about it, I was in a pail.
A bucket.
A pail.
Mr. Bucket,
I have to revert back to my little state.
Oh,
I don't use the bucket anymore.
This is a galvanizing moment for Bashir, because it's sort of a medical fight or flight situation. You could consider this a failure to the degree that Bashir and Dax should leave.
Bashir is standing in this room, and what were people suffering from this illness are now mummies. They're all wrapped in death shrouds, and Bashir is standing among their corpses talking to Dax about, like, fuck, like, all, it wasn't even, it was like some, like, my equipment being here around them is the thing that caused this.
He's fighting this mental battle on three fronts, right? He feels awful about not being able to stop the blight like he thought he would. He regrets offering the false hope that he gave them, even though everyone was cautioning him against offering that.
Yeah.
And then he sort of regrets his own arrogance, which is, it's so personal to him. Like, you almost cannot separate the arrogance from Dr. Bashir. And so it's almost as if he regrets being who he is.
I wanted Kira to pick us up and maybe like, yep, solved a planetary crisis all by myself.
Yeah, that insight horrifies him. And all three of these things add up to how he's feeling.
And I love Dax's advice in that moment, because she says, like, yeah, there was arrogance in thinking that you could just find the cure really quickly.
But it's even more arrogant to think there isn't a cure just because you couldn't find it.
It really knocks him on his ass. So like, his last moment on the planet is him going to see this mural, which is a mural that that Ikoria's late husband painted of, like, an image of this planet before it was laid waste in the way it is, like a kind of idealized, like, image from the past. And he's like checking it out, and she starts talking to him over his shoulder, and he turns around and realizes that she has gone red.
She's got the quickening.
But is not resentful, you know? Like, she was there in the most horrifying moment of this experience, and she's, like, feeling like the future wasn't totally fucked for a few days was actually great, you know? Like, it was worth it just for that, for the feeling that I experienced.
When people describe their friends and family as being brave for being diagnosed with a mortal disease, I feel like more often than not, this is what that's describing.
Yeah.
And I think it is Ikoria that gives Bashir permission to stay behind. Like, Bashir and Dax go up to the runabout, but Bashir makes it clear that he's got to stay behind. His job isn't over.
I thought this was such an interesting moment, because we're 34 minutes into a 44-minute episode.
Yeah. The timing of this is wild.
And this is where a character heads home and grapples with the horror of what they've experienced or whatever in 9.9 out of 10 television episodes.
Yeah.
And because, like, the flow of time in this episode has not been, it's not been real time, but it's been like a consistent rate of speed, I feel like. And then after this point, what happens, it takes place over a course of, like, weeks and months, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the first 34 minutes of this episode happen over the course of 1 week, and then the last 10 minutes happen over, like, several weeks.
Oh, and the only reason you know that is because at the very end you see the pylon has been reattached to Deep Space Nine. It's funny to, like, so we beam down to the surface with Bashir, and it's like Bashir and four suitcases.
Yeah, he's got all the pelicans of medical equipment.
Yeah.
And he is redoubling himself in the effort to solve this problem.
And Ikoria is Bashir's only patient. Like, we had a wide angle on this problem for 30-ish minutes, like you say, but now we are just in Ikoria's home. And if it's going to get solved, it's going to get solved here and with her.
It's back to basics. It's Dr. Quinn-style medicine that he's practicing. And, you know, everything has to be without technology. He's, like, he's listening to her chest through, like, a old-timey stethoscope device. He's checking her blood and discovers that, like, the antigen is not even present in her blood anymore, which is confounding, but an important piece of information.
And we've got a deadline here, right?
Yeah.
Because Ikoria isn't going to live long enough to see the baby through to term. And that's a problem.
Yeah.
If they want this baby to live.
She's got 6 weeks left, but he could induce in 2 if he can keep her alive until then.
And that's the thing that gives you the timeline, I think, more than anything, is that you eventually see this baby born.
Right.
Bashir should have grown the beard, right?
That would have been great, yeah. If he was, like, scraggly by the time they came back and got him.
I would have loved that. He's done it before.
He's done it before, yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting that he focuses on making sure that the baby is okay first, but like, the idea here is that Bashir has basically left Starfleet for all intents and purposes. Like, he has dedicated his life to solving the problem on this planet.
You know, until you said that, that was not clear to me. But it's true. It's absolutely true. He basically left his comm badge on the runabout.
Right. And has made an arrangement to, like, call for pickup when he has solved the problem. Like, he is...
Right.
It's like Dark Knight Rises when Bruce Wayne realizes that he can't escape the pit when he's got the rope tied around his waist. Like, the rope is the thing that's holding him back.
Indeed.
So he holds on, and there's an interesting scene where Okoria wakes up in the middle of the night, and Trevian is there, and he's like, he's putting like mustard on her forehead.
Am I dead?
Is that what you want? I can end your suffering.
That's unconsensual mustard.
Yeah.
Ben, I don't think anyone wants to wake up that way. Like, you wake up and it's the angel of death, Trevian.
Yeah. Trevian
is like the oldest dude on this planet. Like, everybody's like blown away at how long he's lived with this illness. And he pitches her in this moment, like, hey, I know you're really uncomfortable right now, and I've got ideas about how to help you with that. W/R/T drinking poison.
Would it have helped if Trevian was kind in his medical ministrations? Because there's like, I've been watching a lot of Deadwood lately, and the doctor in Deadwood is like bedraggled and drunk and angry at his circumstances. He really is, because he's seen a lot of death. And it frustrates him. And it frustrates him when he sees people kill each other senselessly. But he's also inherently kind at the same time. And I felt like that might have been missing. Like, he is killing these people, but it's mercy. Like, kindness and mercy go together, but he only has one of those ingredients.
Yeah. I think this episode acknowledges that about him. The concept of bedside manner has to be elucidated. He is expressing the only kind of kindness he knows, which is an extremely limited, mercy-killing form of kindness.
Yeah. Bashir walks in on them and stops the mustarding.
Yeah.
Kind of scares him away.
Like, he has the conversation with Trevian we've been wanting to see had the entire time, which is, why is death the only thing you focus on or care about?
Right.
And, you know, Trevian's deal is that, like, the long life I've had, the shit I've seen, like, this is the most humane way to deal with the way life is for me and my people.
Yeah, he's a doctor with a 1,000-mile stare.
But he leaves without euthanizing Okoria, and the next scene is her having her baby.
Morn.
Dear sweet.
Morn.
Evening, everybody.
Morn.
Hammer time.
There's some pushing. There's some breathing.
Gotta do that.
There's some catching.
Yeah. And she's like in a weird, she's at a weird angle. I feel
it
like.
It looks like he's working on her feet.
Yeah. Not everybody keeps their genitalia in the same place, Captain.
Oh, yeah. That could be it.
Also, she does look like she's sitting in a chair in the shots of her.
Yeah.
It's like, where's this baby coming out from?
A moment of light in a very dark episode is that the baby comes out and it's blight-free.
Blight-free baby!
And they have that moment in the town square where Trevian, like, Lion Kings this baby.
Yeah.
In front of everyone.
She gets, like, her last moment alive is finding out that her baby doesn't have the blight.
Yeah.
And then it is Trevian's trophy to hold up.
Trevian's like, you mind if I'm just going to reach in. Okay, it looks like you're dead. This shot is amazing. It looks like it's a crane on a dolly.
Yeah.
Because it ends on Bashir kind of standing in some ruins watching this from a remove. And it's really great. This whole composition's great.
The way he's framed kind of implies that he is isolated from them and also not really there to take the credit for what he has done.
Exactly. Yeah, he's been so wounded by the deaths of everyone early in the episode and the deaths to come, because all this does is solve the future problem. And this is something that the button of the episode interrogates, because Sisko greets Bashir with gratitude.
Good work.
But Bashir can't really relish any of those good feelings because he's sad about those that he's lost, and he knows that basically everyone you met there is dead.
Yeah.
Like, the babies are the only ones that are safe going forward.
The next generation, like, from the moment he set foot on that planet going forward, are the only people that have a hope of surviving.
Yeah.
But and he's gone home with the problem of trying to solve the virus problem remotely, and it gives the impression that it's going to be an obsession of his.
It's a Pyrrhic victory.
Yeah. Did you like the episode, Adam?
Yeah, I really did. I thought it was great. It was nice to have one with Bashir again. I thought, getting back to what we were describing before, this set was fantastic, and it was really like the high point in the season as far as sets go.
Yeah.
Almost wish that like they could have used this for other episodes. It was so good and developed and detailed. It was Star Wars-y in its quality. Like there's like, it's not just exteriors, or it's not just one main interior that's a big room. There are areas of interiors here that are all dressed uniquely. It just shows such an attention to detail that it's just impossible to sustain in a 26-episode season. So when you get it, you really appreciate it.
I mean, it's so much more detailed and developed than any exterior scene we ever got in TNG.
Yeah.
And it's just so spectacular. It feels like it's an exterior worthy of a multi-episode arc, you know?
Right.
It's that level, and the fact that it is just one episode is amazing. Which is to say nothing of the story that is told using it. Like, it's well conceived and well suited to the story.
The episode that I'm thinking of is the one from TNG where Data wakes up on that planet with the radioactive material.
Yeah.
And has to save the people there. Like, this is a type of Star Trek story.
Right.
Where you're on a planet's surface and you're there to save.
This is not the courtyardification of an outdoor set that TNG often resorted to.
Nor is it the happy ending that episodes of that era had. To end on a darker note here, I think, shows a maturity that would continue. This feels momentous in a way, this episode.
Yeah.
So I really liked it. Sounds like you did too.
Yeah, I really did too. Yeah, this is an episode that I have always remembered from my first watch through of Deep Space Nine, and that was a watch through that was not complete by any means, but I've always remembered this episode as being particularly good, and I could never remember like where in the order it came, but this is a particularly good episode in a show that has really come into its own, I think.
Yeah, you know, you got basically a war movie in To the Death in the episode that came before, and then the show takes a right-hand turn into kind of a classic story told really well.
It
feels like a interesting part in this series' development.
I feel like great music in the last couple episodes. Like, that episode and this episode both felt like the music was really on a new level.
Yeah. Well, one place we tend to play music in every episode is the reading of our Priority One messages. Ben, you want to get to those?
Yeah, let's do it.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Need a supplemental income.
Supplemental income?
Supplemental.
Supplemental.
Yeah, it's extra.
By the interest alone, could be enough to buy this ship.
Ben, our first Priority One message is from Elizabeth, and it is to David. And the message goes like this: congratulations on completing your doctorate in classics.
Wow.
We survived. I am so proud of you, and I'm looking forward to spending the rest of my life with such a smart and knowledgeable husband.
Damn.
I love you so much, even more than Star Trek.
What? I find it hard to believe that anybody loves anything more than they love Star Trek.
Elizabeth has a great capacity for love,
yeah,
it seems. and David seems pretty lucky. Wow, doctorate in classics. I hope Elizabeth is also rich.
Yeah, because she'll know how to live life as the partner of somebody raking it in the classics racket.
Yeah, congratulations, David. Good job by you, and to you both, actually.
Yeah.
Jeez, getting it done.
That sounds great. As a person who has a partner who has gotten a higher degree, I can feel that pain, you know, like the struggle of going and getting it and getting it done. It's a big deal. So congrats to both of you.
It's best when you have a great partner seeing it through. So looks good for them.
Adam, our next priority one message is from B, and it's to Pi symbol, and the message is $.
Whoa, that's it?
Yeah, it's from...
I thought you were going to continue.
It's from capital B. It's to Pi symbol, and it's $ is the message. This might be the lowest number of characters used per dollar spent of any priority one message we have ever received.
The only way to do any less would be to have less width with the character. So if you were to do a message from I, and the message is for lowercase l.
Yeah.
And the message itself was...
numeral one.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, yeah.
That record's hard to beat.
There it is. It's up there on the leaderboard. So anybody that wants to beat it, head to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. And it's $100 for a personal message or $200 for a commercial message. And doing so helps support the production of The Greatest Generation. Hey, Adam.
It's that, Ben.
Did you find yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Incredible.
Drunk Shimoda!
We talked about it a little bit earlier. It's that street magic scene with Bashir. Like, Bashir is desperate at this point. He's got to somehow prove to the village that he has medical prowess.
Yeah.
How do you do it? You need to do something flashy and public. And so he am become miracle worker.
Yeah.
He isn't gross about it because he doesn't like hold his arms up in the air and say like, I'm Dr. Bashir, I've come to save you. Like, he lets the kid tell the story, and I think that's classy. But as far as a Shimoda move goes, doing street magic is Shimoda to me.
Yeah.
And in an episode that was fairly dark, that was a moment of, if not levity, that was a moment of light that I seized on to. So I had a hard time choosing a Shimoda, so I made that one mine. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, that scene is the Shimoda scene. My Shimoda is Ypran. I almost felt like Bashir was paying Ypran off in that scene, because like he marches over and really like makes a big show of leaning over the kid and looking really closely at the laser when Bashir is
Ypran's the guy that wins three card Monty in order to get the tourist to play three card Monty.
Yeah, he was totally a plant in the audience in a way that was totally like, I, you know, obviously not what the writers intended, and I don't think that's what is intended in the performance, but I think the camera direction, just to keep Ypran as like an interested observer for whom this will be an impressive display, who then, you know, goes and shows up later to become one of Bashir's victims, is just the staging of his character is so hilarious to me that he got my Shimoda.
Ypran, played by Dylan Haggerty, I think just deserves to be named. He does a lot of work in this episode.
Yeah.
And I think he's really good in it.
Yeah, he's that guy.
You know, we named him. We should probably name Ikoria. That was Ellen Wheeler. And Boshi and Dylan, like, really, they are above the title actors in this episode. They're great.
Yeah, really good.
Gotta get that cold press action. Get that
cold press action.
Am I right? Yeah.
Am I right? Moms, can't live with them. Can't find a great gift for them. It's madness. And it's the same every year. Mother's Day comes around and it's like, what's it gonna be this year? Another robe? Another candle? Slippers? A sweater? Flowers? We've got to do better than that, right? Well, you can, and it's actually the best gift you could possibly give a loved one, an Aura frame. Now, we have a policy to only do ads on our show for things that we actually like and use, and I gotta tell you, the Aura frame is probably the best gift I've ever given. The folks I've given an Aura frame to love it, and I love it too, because when you give an Aura frame, you're not just giving a person a bunch of old pictures, you're giving them new pictures. Every time you send one, do it. Right now, Aura has a great sale for Mother's Day. Viewers can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com, and the code is SCARVS at checkout to show your support for the show. Terms and conditions apply.
Mother's Day is coming up, and one of the best gifts you can give a mom that you might share a bed with is doing some yard work. Some yard work downstairs, if you know what I mean. With Manscaped. This season, make sure you groom your carpets and your drapes with the leaders in below-the-waist grooming. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVS at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVS at manscaped.com. Nothing like a little spring cleaning in your pants to let the mother of your children know how much you appreciate her continuing to put up with you.
Hey, when you listen to podcasts, it really just comes down to whether or not you like the sound of everyone's voices. My voice is one of the sounds you'll hear on the podcast Dr. Game Show, and this is the voice of co-host and fearless leader Joe Firestone.
This is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, and we play them with callers over Zoom we've never spoken to in our lives. So that is basically the concept of the show. Pretty chill.
So take it or leave it, bucko. And here's what some of the listeners have to say.
It's funny, wholesome, and it never fails to make me smile.
I just started listening and I'm already binging it. I haven't laughed this hard in ages. I wish I discovered it sooner.
You can find Dr. Game Show on MaximumFun.org.
Video games can make you laugh.
They can make you cry.
They can even make you sing.
We're the hosts of Triple Click.
It's a podcast about video games.
This is an exciting time for new games, from Diablo to Final Fantasy.
From Starfield to Street Fighter.
From Zelda to, oh, who are we kidding? We're just going to talk about Zelda.
Whether you play games or you just like hearing about them, we've got you covered.
Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
What do we have coming up for the next episode, Ben?
The next episode is season 4, episode 24, Body Parts. Misdiagnosed with a terminal disease, Quark sells his body parts on the Ferengi market to pay off his debts, then finds himself unable to break the contract. Another terminal disease episode, Adam.
That's a problem for him.
Yeah, no kidding.
Those contracts are ironclad.
Yeah. Do you want to find out how we're going to be doing this episode, Adam?
The only way to do that is by consulting the Game of Buttholes Rule of the Prophets. And I have done so, Ben. We're on square 25 currently. Three squares ahead, we have a Naked Now episode.
Damn. That's the one where we have to draw a bath and then record the show from our bathtubs.
A very compromised episode, yeah. That would be.
You're required to learn as you play. Roll.
I've got the die in my hand. I'm rolling that die. Ooh. Oh, that was close. I rolled a 4.
Chula! Did I win?
Hardly.
We hopped over it. We're on square 29. Ben, had we landed on the bathtub square, I had the mind to just record in my usual studio setting and just like...
have like a basin of water that you were splashing periodically?
Yeah, do the foot bath style.
I would do it, man.
I know you would.
You would
too. You're
brave. You gotta do it.
I know. Well, as it is, regular old episode by us.
We can always hit it eventually, Adam.
Yeah, plenty of buttholes to go around on this game board, right?
Indeed.
Plenty of people to thank to go around, too.
That's true.
We got to thank most of all those who choose to support The Greatest Generation, Friendly Fire, and The Greatest Discovery over at MaximumFun.org/donate. Those that support on a monthly level are able to keep us working at a monthly level. A good free way to support the show happens on your podcatcher. You can leave a 5-star review and rating over at Apple Podcasts, or if you're using any other podcatcher, a 5-thing review would be most appreciated. By doing that, you help elevate the notice of a show like ours, a show which still has gone unnoticed by the Star Trek industrial complex.
Please join us in celebrating the great work of Bill Tilley, who makes hilarious trading cards about every episode of the show. He puts them up on Twitter using the hashtag GreatestGen. I know he's been posting them on the Facebook group. He now has a Tumblr.
That's right.
I think it is Bill Tilley 1973.tumblr.com.
We're going to meet up with him at Star Trek Las Vegas.
Yeah, we sure are.
I'm looking forward to that.
We're going to be meeting up with him this week.
I'm going to get Tilly a hoof.
Yeah.
There's no escape for him.
Yeah, he will drink all the hoofs. there might be something bigger than the hoof at that little stand. And
the yard of hoof?
I think there might be a yard of hoof.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I don't want to kill the guy, but...
If there's a yard of anything, I need a 2-ingredient beverage.
Yeah.
It's the only way.
Bill Tilley drinks for free when he's in our presence.
That's right.
And, he does a great job. Also doing a great job out there is J.J. Lendl, who makes movie posters of every episode of Deep Space Nine. And he posts them the Sunday before our episode goes out.
Adam Ragusea drinks for free in our presence. He, of course, is the person behind the great music you hear on The Greatest Generation. He, in many cases, took the original music of Dark Materia, who offered that to us after we asked him.
Check out all the other great shows on MaximumFun.org.
And with that, we'll be back at you next time with another great episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and an episode of The Greatest Generation Deep Space Nine. It seems to be in need of a lawyer. Maybe even a country lawyer.
Hell yeah.
Trivago.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.